all the wrong articles.
He would not, as he said, define that beyond saying that there is a real presence there. He would not, of course, subscribe necessarily he to transubstantiation. Or the Father Seeley, who immediately came in, you notice he said, but you may believe in transubstantiation, which is true. Which suggests that the 39 articles are not always honored with the highest doctrinal authority in the English Church. Nevertheless, they represent both the historic belief of the English Church and, as of 1964, for that matter, represent the highest summation of Reformed English doctrine. In the 30th of both kinds, notice the cup of the Lord should not be denied to the laity. It does not mean, as we also heard from Father Cockrell, that always the laity will receive under both species, because as when given to the saint, only the consecrated waiter is brought. Now, one of the most uncompromising texts in the 39 articles is the 31st on the Mass. The offering of Christ once made is that perfect redemption and so on for all the sins of the whole world, and there is none other satisfaction for sin but that alone. Now, notice this. It would not be accurate, Catholic theology, which this, however, implies as Catholic, that somehow the Mass adds to, supplements, fills out the cross. It does nothing of the kind. There is not one syllable in authentic Catholic teaching which says that the Mass somehow supplements, complements, adds to the cross. And consequently, the connective term wherefore is, and I must use the word, it is a caricature of Catholicism. Because the reason why Masses are dropped, or the sacrifice of the Mass is dropped, if, as this article implies, because there are other satisfactions for sin than the cross, that's not true. Because all the efficacy of every Mass comes only from the cross. It is not, therefore, as though it is the cross alongside of the Mass or Masses, as though somehow there are new sacrifices which are independent of the cross. It certainly is the first sentence of why I understand my English. And that is not Catholic teaching. Therefore, when it is said that wherefore, for that reason, the sacrifices of the Mass were blasphemous fables and dangerous deceits, certainly would be. Wouldn't be fables and dangerous deceits. It'd be nonsense. Suppose those are blasphemous fables. And therefore that the priest did offer Christ for the quick and the dead. The priest doesn't offer Christ. By implication is meant, as certainly is meant here, that it is not Christ offering himself. It is Christ offering himself even in the Mass. Indeed, through the priest. But the whole passage there implies what can only be described as a caricature of the Catholic faith. That alongside of the Mass, or alongside of the cross, beyond the cross, beside the cross, there are other sacrifices in which, around the cross, Christ offered himself, in the Mass, the priest offers Christ. You would shiver, except there's nothing to shiver at, because there's nothing there. There's not Catholic teaching. Anyhow, this and a thing like this gives warrant to the High Church Anglicans to have the sacrifice of the Mass and to say that their offering of Mass is not in contravention of the 31st article. And that's true, it isn't. because what is here rejected is a non-existent fable, which is called a fable and is graced with the name blasphemous. It is a construct of the mind that formulated the 31st article. But the thing is, this remains on the books. And this is the thing which, of course, Catholicism has lived with for 400 years in the English, in England. The marriage of priests, we've seen that in a previous context. Yes, sir?
Do you assume that they stumble over in writing it this way, words like sacrifice, and probably read into it something that...
You mean by sacrifice in their own, you mean your own tradition?
As Roman Catholics have used this term.
Well, the word sacrifice is always used, and even sacrifices. But the Council of Trent explicitly said there is only one oblation which redeemed the world, which then is renewed. In other words, the renewal of that sacrifice. The representation of that sacrifice. But notice it is always that sacrifice. So you'd have to read into it, friend. I don't know what you would read into it, in fact, except this. So my
question is really this. Is this the result of misunderstanding or deliberate misrepresentation?
Well, I'd say both. I have to say the second. I hate to put it this way. First of all, certainly misunderstanding. Cannot imagine a man, abuser again, was responsible. He was responsible maybe for two things. He was responsible for the section on free will, justification, predestination, which is really reformed thinking, Calvinist thinking, on the concept of relation of grace and free will. He was responsible, we know, for the 31st article. And Bucer was a priest, had taught theology, he knew. In other words, he knew what had been taught. Now, it is not unlikely, at least I hope, this is being charitable perhaps, it is not unlikely that he thought the only explanation that Catholics could afford or could give for their sacrifices of the Mass would be to make them independent of the cross. Now, admittedly, it is quite a problem, in fact, an insoluble mystery, to explain how you can have sacrifices of the Mass, which are nevertheless the one sacrifice of the cross which Christ renews on the altar. In other words, it could well be that men like Bucer and others, in trying to explain how you can have only one sacrifice of the cross which is renewed on the altar, that when you try to explain it, you end up with this. Of the Catholic Church.
Those two words, renewed and what was the other one used?
Reenacted and human race, and that's the Church, which is with its multiple human constructs, among which is the Mass and the priesthood. And in other words, the idea that God would use human instruments when he's reading Catholic teaching is really set aside. See, there's no word to that effect. It is put as though these are human creations conceived by man and now claiming to lead man to God. Priests offering Christ. You shiver when you hear the words. As though this priest is offering Christ, independently of Christ offering himself to the hands of this.
I stumble over that word sacrifice.
Yeah, all right. Well, sacrifice the same way. Given, in other words, the idea of something which is precious, offered to God in some way and put out of human use as an acknowledgement of God's sovereignty and as a petition for his grace, which is a classic definition of sacrifice, he is verified so Catholics believe in the Mass. And if we have the body and blood of Christ, which is certainly precious, which is offered and were able to die and would die, the acknowledgement of God's sovereignty and interpretation of the Trinity. But behind it stands something which, of course, is able to be sacrificed. You've got to have a Christ on the altar. You cannot intelligently or intelligibly speak of a sacrifice of a man unless there's something to be sacrificed. There must be a Christ on the altar to be sacrificed. If you don't have him, you've got to have a sacrifice.
How that word sacrifice got in there, this is, I guess, my first presence.
Well, the word sacrifice got in there by the real presence. The real presence.
When you say renewed, is it implied that the sacrifice is taking place again?
In a sense, yes.
If that's, if I may object then, but Christ can die only once.
That's right.
Yes.
But he can offer himself, from our viewpoint, as often as he makes an act of his human will, which is what he is sacrificing with. In other words, if the essence of sacrifice, did we have, I don't know whether we touched on this in class, the essence of sacrifice? Yeah. Well, my desk is around, let's take it apart. There are, for every sacrifice, that are called the material and the formal element. In other words, there is the that which is offered or sacrificed. So the the element offered and the actual offering on the cross, the material element, was of course Christ's human body, which was living and which allowed itself to be killed, and Christ died in the process of sacrificing himself. Shedding of blood, the actual death of Christ. The formal offering on the cross began already at the Last Supper. In fact, began when Christ came into the world, but at least we usually identify it with Christ's declaration when he offered the elements. This is my body which will be given for you, and my blood which will be shed for you, will be the future tense, which then he actually enacted or effected on the cross. Now, this is really, in the sense of essentially, what constitutes the sacrifice. And that thing can be repeated, even though the actual material element, which is offered only once. Now, the comparison that I use in my teaching of this, some of my former students, some I think here from the class might remember, the comparison of, say, a Christian being taken captive by the communists, say in present-day Hungary or Poland, and threatened with death unless he becomes a communist and denies his faith. Becomes, in other words, not just a card member, but an actual member of the Communist Party, and implicitly denies God's existence. But he refuses to do that. He's put in jail, given a summary trial, condemned to death. And all this while, his will is firm. See? This is external. This is internal. And this is in the will. It is the free oblation of something precious to God. Now take this Christian who is willing to lay down his life in profession of his faith as a witness of his beliefs. Suppose shortly before his execution he is reprieved and dismissed. toward behaving himself. And suppose he is, in the same way, say, seven times, just to use an odd number, suppose he is seven times taken captive and six times reprieved. On the seventh, he is actually healed. And he dies. And if we were to ask, how many times has he sacrificed his life to God in profession of his faith? How many times had he sacrificed himself?
Seven times.
At least, over, we're just trying to make sense of it, eh? At least there is an intelligible sense in which we can say that he offered himself seven times. He witnessed to the faith seven times and thereby sacrificed himself. Albeit he died only once. As Catholics understand their theology, this is simply the same thing, but in reverse. Christ began by dying and showing the sincerity of his oblation by actually dying on the cross. Then, and this is where the faith comes in, that whenever Mass is offered, he is really there on the altar to be offered and to offer himself, and he is the real priest behind the Mass, that what he does is, now the word renew has got to be used because of our limitation of human language. It isn't that there's some kind of an IBM calculator or you name it. See, that Christ is keeping up with all the Masses and to make sure that he has a Mass being offered there. I'll unite myself with that Mass in the Congo or in Zululand or in Chicago or in Kalamazoo. No, I mean, that would be pretty crude. But Christ, by one act of the human will from the very beginning, identified, so the Catholic believes, he is reoffering himself each time that he is placed on the altar in the twofold consecration to verify the concept of a sacrifice. Or what's sacrificial about it? All that you need, essentially, namely, a human will. He's got a human will there because he's a human being offering himself. What's the himself? His human nature. It's there to his heavenly Father. Well, there's no blood. That's right. Because the essence of sacrifice is not that the actual offering be made visibly or physically, provided it had taken place, or with our Christian taking by the communists, would take place. And therefore, and this probably will help to explain it. Perhaps the easiest way to understand what Catholics mean by the Mass is to ask anybody what he means by the Last Supper. And if you can make sense of the Last Supper, you have, even though you're not Catholic, that made sense of the Mass. Because Christ didn't die at the Last Supper. No bloodshed. Yet, did he offer himself? Sure, he said he was. And the same kind of offering, which unbloody indeed, which took place at the Last Supper in anticipation of the cross, so Catholic believe, takes place now subsequent to the cross. Well, much more could be said just to clarify.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Need a sacrifice be tangible to be a sacrifice?
Well, technically, yes, in the sense that sacrifice, as commonly understood in religions of all kinds, whether Jewish or the Oriental or, say, Christian, sacrifice in the traditional sense of the word, yes, is something which somehow has materiality about it. And the reason is very simple. That it corresponds to man's physical, visible nature. In other words, it is his external token of the invisible sacrifice, which really is the thing that counts. Right? But if he were just to say that I'm offering myself or that I'm making sacrifices, and he never really makes them, well, it would be at least suspect. And consequently, there were always There was always something which was de facto physically offered. Now it's possible, of course, as we know from the prophets of the Old Law, to offer externally sacrifices in quotation marks where the heart was not there. There are always the passages that Calvin especially chooses. I don't want your sacrifices. What I want is a humble and contrite heart. Of course, of course. It's a humble and contrite heart which is behind the sacrifices. And the very words in the Old Law, for example, where the prophets, take Jeremiah particularly, some of the most devastating blasts against the killing of bullocks and oxen. See? I don't want the blood. I've got all. I made it. I think I've got nostrils like the rest of you, so that I can smell the stuff. See, this is Yahweh speaking through Jeremiah. Well, he isn't saying stop offering bullocks. What he is saying is stop offering bullocks and not offering yourselves behind that visible sacrifice. The visible sacrifice is always and everywhere. In other words, we're just too much body and soul to claim sincerely that we're offering ourselves in spirit without the body somehow contributing.
So this would be for the benefit other material humans like myself. God doesn't need that himself.
No, he doesn't. Well, on the other hand, true. But that's not the only kind of sacrifice. Because technically speaking, the sacrifice that he was offered over among the Jews, or the Catholicism believes in, may indeed include sacrifices such as you mentioned, where other people, or where people benefit. See, not myself, otherwise I could hardly call it a sacrifice. Profiting with the right hand that I give with the left. But, technically speaking, sacrifice means giving up in such a way that, frankly, nobody may profit. And we find, and this of course is something which scandalizes American pragmatists, when the Hindu, say, pours ghee, G-H-double-E, which is melted butter, on fire, as a sacrifice, say, to Shiva. Well, this is precious to him. Milk to begin with, and butter more so, whether stiff or in hot weather, melted. Okay? If that's poured on the fire, that's a sacrifice to him. And nobody gets any benefit except the fire. In other words, there is a certain sense in which God is sovereign master of the universe. Wants, and so all religious instinct recognizes, wants some self-sublimation, self-sacrifice, with no profit to anybody, in token of my dependence upon him.
Is this symbolized at all in any Christian church in this way that the participants in the sacrament bring the elements?
Right, they bring the elements and they are consumed. And, say, in Catholic liturgy, which is not only Catholic, say the burning up candles, the setting up of flowers, and by the way, not putting them in pots so you can, after the service is over, you can pick them back and put them and sell them in the floral shop.
But I bring my bread and my little flask of wine, and the next person does this.
Well, that's part of it. That's part of it.
Which church?
Symbolized.
Is there a church that does this?
Well, in the early church, and even now, as a matter of fact, while normally, as far as bringing the elements of bread and wine, well, first of all, you get all kinds of bread, you get all kinds of wine.
My point is, I read this and I just wondered how literal I should say.
It's being taken, sure. And even now, there's a symbolic action in many of the Catholic churches, it will be more so in a few months, where, for example, they take wafers of the bread as a token of it's their offering, you see, and placing it into the chalice of the ciborium for consecration of Mass, or bringing various elements of sacrifice, foodstuffs, and so on, or, the offertory collection, the money.
I pay for it that way. But I'm actually bringing a little piece of bread with me.
Crucial, Article 37. We'll read the two texts, first the short one, then you will look at your own, which I had to borrow from somebody. The 37th American version reads, "The power of the civil magistrate extended to all men, as well clergy as laity, in all things temporal. But hath no authority in things purely spiritual, and behold, to be the duty of all men who are professors of the gospel to be respectful, obedient to the civil authority, regularly and legitimately constituted." This is so typically American. And in fact, he was composed right after the Revolutionary War, where, as a matter of fact, even the gunpowder had hardly dried from the war. It, by the way, indicates how clean became the break between Anglicanism and American Anglicanism. Let us read Article 37 and we'll read it through, if you don't mind. The article was not only in existence all the way back to, well, frankly, the Queen's Majesty, and of course that means Mrs. Aronofsky, it was framed under Queen Elizabeth, but has been in existence until and including modern times. It is right now the law of the English Church in England. And, in fact, one of the features of the English Church when nations or countries became autonomous, the first thing they always did, including, for example, the English Church of Canada, was to revise and completely revamp the 37th Article. In fact, no American could profess the 37th Article. If you profess the 37th article as reading in the English Church, Anglicans, "The Queen's Majesty hath a chief power in this realm of England, and over her dominions, unto whom the chief government of all estates of this realm, whether the ecclesiastical or civil, in all causes that appertain, is not nor ought to be subject to any foreign jurisdiction." Yeah. That, in a way, is a blanket statement of the civil authority and, allow me to say, and this is significant, that for the first time in Western history was such a statement juridically built into both a creed and a nation. And it is said it is not coincidental that the one who did so was a woman. It is absolutely uncompromising, as only women can be uncompromising. God bless them. "Where we attribute to the Queen's Majesty the chief government, by which titles we understand the minds of some slanderous folk to be offended." Now, notice the correlation. "We give not to our princes the ministry either of God's word or of sacraments, to which state the injunctions also lately set forth by Elizabeth, our Queen, doth most plainly testify. But that only prerogative," what a prerogative, "which we see to have been given always to all godly princes in Holy Scriptures by God Himself," that equals Old Testament theology. And it's true. It's true. David and others. Although even there were certain distinctions, as you know, nevertheless, by and large, and was respected by the Jewish people as their spokesman for government. "Then they should rule all estates and degrees committed to their charge by God," now again, "whether ecclesiastical or temporal, and restrain with a civil sword the stubborn," hence the power of coercion. You couldn't possibly make it different. "And then to make sure who is eliminated as the foreign jurisdiction, the Bishop of Rome hath no jurisdiction in the realm of England. And then to make sure these things will be obeyed, the laws of the realm may punish Christian men with death for heinous and grievous offenses, such as, for example, disobeying the above. Well, the rest is a platitude. Yes?
When you say this is Old Testament theology, do you have in mind something like the theocratic monarchy?
Exactly. In other words, Erastus, the English divine, and hence the word is called, the term is called Erastianism, argued, this was his argumentation. This is the way, by the way, it's always been interpreted. The 37th article by the English divines has always been interpreted in terms of Erastus, who said there is a lineal continuity between the Old and the New Testaments, and that just as in the Old Law, the one civil magistrate was also the religious ruler of his people, and that is true. So in the New Law, civil rulers who are Christian, and of course he would allow that, they had to be Christian, they thereby became the authoritarian rulers, not just of the state, but also of the church. And there again, Erastus had not a small amount, well, the then relatively modern history to go by, because it was a regular claim of the civil princes. They did claim to have, and how? And the English monarchs were no exception. In fact, it was because of that that a Becket lost his head. A Becket lost his head because, though Archbishop of Canterbury, he had the nerve to resist Henry, who claimed exactly what this says. So you had the scripture woven in the Old Law, you had the frequent claim in the New Law, and then, admittedly, the Roman pontiffs had resisted that, and the bishops, claiming, in other words, no, there are two societies. They are distinct. They should cooperate. All kinds of problems, nevertheless, the civil has no jurisdiction in matters spiritual over the political has no jurisdiction over the church in matters spiritual. This, of course, once you eliminate the Pope, this was a logical consequence for the English Church.
In the Commonwealth, don't they accept the Anglican Church for the Queen, the present Queen, as defender of the faith? I mean, this.
That's right. Well, they do.
They haven't eliminated them.
They have not changed it.
No.
Now, of course, it becomes somewhat anomalous, doesn't it, for the modern English?
Well, it's just.
Well, the trouble is, of course, that it has never been, the church has never been disestablished. And the classic, all kinds of classic examples, but in 1928, when the Book of Common Prayer was being revised, which, as you know, is the book that pretty much synthesizes Anglican teaching. Changes were being made, and incidentally, now among those changes were also some relative to Article 37. Okay? Parliament, understandably, refused to go along with it. So do you know what happened? They have an unofficial Book of Common Prayer for the English Church. It's revised, all right. However, they didn't have the nerve to eliminate Article 37. It would have meant civil war. Which, of course, the American Revolution, in a way, was. Civil in the sense that it was against the mother country. And, by the way, not to know Article 37 is not to understand the background, for example, to the close relationship between church and state, say, in the colonies, the meaning of the First Amendment. You should always, and I hope you can remember this, the First Amendment of the American Constitution is directly, to use a repetition, against Article 37 of the Anglican Creed. They didn't want it. And they made sure, and of course, they're just a matter of months' difference. In fact, there were some people, members of the Episcopal Church, who were in the Congress, Constitutional Congress, who also didn't want it. In fact, they came to the United States because they were becoming they were being often hounded by this authority. Even those who were members of the English Church, certainly others. Yes?
Well, I was going to say, though, you read, and especially in this Article 37 of 39 Articles, and you you can get the idea that the Queen and everything, you've got to obey the Anglican Church and that, and they're very intolerant. But actually, I think that the English are more tolerant toward other religions. I mean, for instance, the Catholic Church in England are paid by the state.
Yes, these schools and so on. Oh, yes. Well, much has happened. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, here the thing is, this is the historic creed. It has never been repudiated. Mm-hmm. And what in theory still holds the English Church together is this. Mm-hmm. In practice, there have been fabulous deviations. And most commentators say it's just a matter of time when the English Church will become disestablished. And then, of course, fend for itself. At which time, of course, this will be revised and the 37 article will have to be removed.
It was under Queen Victoria that Catholics were allowed to take public office and so on again, wasn't it?
Yes, indicating, however, that up to three centuries, see, this had been seriously followed, and that it is only, by the way, however, under duress, you just take the history of Ireland, as any authentic Irishman will know, is the story of centuries of blood, where this was especially, for example, and restrain with a civil sword the stubborn and evildoers. Article 37 was appealed to on religious grounds for the elimination of a lot of people, so that it was under duress that by now, the English Church has, you might say, in many ways repudiated its own principles.
Implied in this article on the Anglican Church, does that indicate that the Queen would have authority in matters concerning belief?
Oh, indeed.
She appoints.
In other words, it wasn't limited to just externals.
Oh, my goodness. Take, for example,
in a way, became a Pope.
Did you watch the coronation of the Queen? Did you notice the cope that she had on? That symbolism goes all the way back. And an example of the authority exercised over the Church, apart from the Book of Common Prayer, this, by the way, comes up constantly. The Bishop Barnes that I mentioned somewhat embarrassingly to Father Cottrell, I like to bring it up. He almost knows what I'm going to say. But Bishop Barnes of Birmingham, who was one who had completely repudiated not just the Anglican creed, but Christianity. Bishop Barnes wrote books denying the divinity of Christ, claiming that Christianity was just another form of paganism, a higher form indeed. On one dramatic occasion, and this is in his old age when he, you would expect, would have mellowed, he never did as far as belief went. He announced 2 weeks beforehand he would hold a solemn service in his cathedral in Birmingham, in which he would preach against the real presence, knowing by then that many Englishmen believed that Christ is really present under the Eucharistic species. So what did he do? He brought to the pulpit with him 2 chalices, in one of which, he said, there were consecrated hosts, in the other, unconsecrated. At one point, with cameras flashing, he held out a host from the one chalice, a host from the other, and he asked the audience, with a smile, if anybody here could ever tell the difference. How could anybody in his right mind believe that one contained Christ and the other was plain bread? Simultaneous with Bishop Barnes' dramatic gesture in the cathedral, many of his clergy held solemn Eucharistic services of reparation, begging God to have mercy on the Church because of what Barnes was doing and teaching. Yet Barnes could not be touched. Nobody could unseat him because he was a crown appointment. He was appointed by the crown.
this happens, the same thing with the Red Dean.
Red Dean Johnson. Same thing. A communist, supporting communism, teaching communism, writing books in favor of communism, materialism, couldn't be touched because he was appointed by Baldwin, the prime minister.
Inasmuch as Queen Elizabeth seems to press release in that way to be a little bit favorable towards Catholicism, would it ever be possible in the future, by propaganda and filibustering and so on, to pass a different sort of thing through Parliament, much in the way that we've passed civil rights bills here, or wouldn't that be possible under the English government?
Well, I think, of course, much would have to happen in England that I would not be familiar with, but I think England is, in many ways, very traditional-minded. And although the king or queen don't have much real power, they have a lot of symbolic power. And I think something would have to happen to the English nation before that happens. Possible. And some would call it hopeful, but I don't know. Well, let's close with that, if you don't mind. Who's into the fourth of the major streams of the Reformation? And you see with this, we will have completed the quartet, shall we call it? Then we begin to see the developments from this and finally come into the ecumenical movement. We saw something about the Anabaptist in general. The term, remember, stands for two kinds of Protestant theology. One, the continental, and hence the word Anabaptist, to stand for those who rebaptized infants, or better, adults who had been baptized in infancy, and the Free Church movement, otherwise called Congregationalism. This is broader than just the one church, Congregationalist, whose emphasis was on the autonomy of the local congregation, whence come especially our Pilgrim and Puritan fathers. Now, some qualities of the creeds. We are going to take not the first, but the second. There are two creeds, the so-called Schleichnam, which is an early formulation from a small group, still very amorphous, and the one we are going to take, which will be the Mennonite Dordrecht Confession, which is later and represents in a way the high water mark of Anabaptist theology. Actually, there are scores of creeds in this tradition. In a way, they're surprising because technically they shouldn't have creeds, since they were in favor of a purely scriptural theology, the Bible and nothing but the Bible.
Okay? They creed with Christ, you hear them say.
That's right, yes. No creed but Christ. Yet they found out pretty soon you just cannot operate that way with human beings. Some of the qualities of all their creeds, including the one we're going to examine in detail. First, they were quite opposed to the close union of state and church. They were characteristic on the continent, and as we've just seen, in England. And part of the purification behind Puritanism was to purify the English church, or at least Christianity, of its political entanglements. And that's an understatement. Secondly, even on the level of the church itself, while they adopted creeds, they really did not want any kind of real church authority. Consequently, in an Anabaptist and Free Church theology, by definition, there is no overall church authority to which any single member must subscribe. It is basically built, as we saw, on the theory of the covenant. Now this, let's savor this for a moment. This differs radically from the three we have seen so far. If we can use a rough, kind of a slangy expression, the theology we've seen so far and the confessions that somehow concretize those theologies represent, with minor differences, some kind of a faith which comes down from heaven. It is through God, through the scriptures indeed, and then you somehow formulate those teachings that are found somehow outside of the person, coming from God. Whereas in the Anabaptist theology, while God is always the one who gives the faith, nevertheless, it is through the individuals. It is kind of a grassroots theology. And while there is a recognition of Scripture, the emphasis, notice it is stress, the emphasis is on the individual inspiration. By implication, it allows for continued revelation beyond the apostolic age. Now, this is a new dimension. It is in this tradition that later on will come the Adventists, the Mormons, even the Christian Scientists. Thirdly, and corresponding to what we've just seen, there is a stress on the interior, the spiritual, the invisible, and a limitation, and in some cases even the elimination of all externalia, like ritual, even all the sacraments. See, the Quakers come in this tradition, for whom there are no sacraments. It is the naked spirit before God, spirit to spirit. Fourthly, mainly perhaps because among the people who follow the Anabaptist tradition were many hardy souls, generous spirits. Heroic is the only word you can use for them. You find in their teaching and also in their confessions, as we will see, an inclusion of what had been pretty much removed from the other creeds, namely this business of supererogation. Now, they wouldn't call it supererogation. They wouldn't call it the councils, S-E-L-S, but there is even a preoccupation with the higher things, with doing more than you have to, with turning the other cheek. As we will find, there will be, in this tradition, a reluctance, say, to bear arms, to take oaths. There will be a kind of higher form of Christianity. And the very word Puritan, by the way, suggests. They're believing themselves to follow the pure gospel. Finally, it is implied in the preceding, there is a kind of anti-sacramentalism. Now, it's implied in what we've said before. If you concentrate on the interior, if you don't place much stock in ecclesiastical authority, if you stress the inner spirit in communion with God, you will have little place for the sacrament. But it is in this tradition that even if there are sacraments, like the Lord's Supper, their value is pure symbolism. And in the most extreme form, you will have even the removal of any confessions of faith, as in Unitarianism, which is a direct hereditary lineage from the Anabaptist creed. Yes.
Statements such as you're making are generalizations.
Yes.
There are exceptions.
Oh, indeed. And remember, they form, this is the pure stream, as it were, see?
I think you would say Baptist.
Oh, yes.
With the ritual involved in their baptism.
Yes.
Yes.
On the other hand, notice even though I said ritualism, nevertheless, perhaps I should have, we'll bring this up. See, there may be ritual in the sense of something external, but it does not affect anything. It does not confer any grace. It's the faith of the believer.
Even when they dump them, it's still a symbol.
Still symbolic. A lot of symbolism. And maybe they make up with symbolism for what they lack in the content. Now we take up what, in a way, is the most famous of these confessions of faith, the so-called Dordrecht Confession. this confession has found its way into most of the churches in this Anabaptist family. It is often combined with, for example, the Westminster Confession, as with the Baptist readings. It is taken almost pure in the Mennonites, modern American Mennonites. It is followed by people who are generally called fundamentalists. And I would say the Dordrecht Confession, although going back to the early 17th century, typifies what you might call Bible Belt Christianity, whose stress is literalness. When you come to the Bible, you take it literally, and which has developed into sectarianism, where because they lack and even deny any kind of real ecclesiastical authority, where they are pretty much, you might say, at the mercy of each individual congregation. So sectarianism is typical of this type. Also, these confessions, or this confession of faith, represents churches that are unsympathetic, by and large, there are some exceptions, unsympathetic with the ecumenical movement, with the world or national councils of churches, of which, for example, the Mennonites are not members. Now I will take up just an article here and there, stress those that are more significant, and then tie them up with what you're saying. Yes, John?
Hello. Is this Dordrecht, does this name come from the same geographical location of this Reformed Confession called the same city?
Yes.
In Belgium or somewhere?
Yes, and the... We'll see, by the way, before we finish this, we'll see how it has affected the Reformed tradition. Yes.
I've done some reading in the last couple of days about ecumenicity and the ecumenical movement, naturally. This last remark, one author I read posited the idea that, though in this type of church there are very, very few who are in any way sympathetic with the ecumenical movement, he said he would not find it very difficult to find many individuals, larger and smaller groups, who are very much interested in ecumenicity.
Well, yes.
That's a valid expression.
Oh, I think so. What, in other words, they say, and I think they are right in saying, that the overall color, if you can so speak of it, of the ecumenical movement has been to lessen the doctrine and to stress some kind of cooperative, social, and other agencies and efforts. And they are suspicious of that. See, they feel that you are losing that which authenticates Christianity. And I think they are right. They have their own, you might say, ecumenical movement, an effort to find some kind of union. And there was a unit called the Evangelicals, about 15 denominations belong to this, of which there are those who belong to this, you see?
This is the National Association.
Yes. But they are small. And by comparison with the National Council, they are ineffective. Right now, let's just look at the first article, the second paragraph on 293, just to savor a bit of the literalness with which they approach the Scriptures. In this one God that we just described, who worketh all in all, we believe. Him we confess as the creator of all things, visible and invisible, who in 6 days created and prepared. In other words, you will find a regular quotation from Scriptures, and the passages that are quoted, you will notice, tend to be those that call for some kind of a literal rendering. You generally don't find the broad, sweeping, what shall we call them, principle, PLE, quotations from the Scriptures. You do not find the, you might say, the theoretical ideas taken from Scripture. It will be the literal passages, normally. Sometimes, or in fact, often having to do with things that are either countable or tangible or somehow that make for a literal interpretation. In Article 2, now we should combine this with what we're going to see in a few minutes. talking about the fall of man, for which reason our first parents were by God driven out of paradise and cultivated and so on. And that they did, therefore, through this one sin, so far apostatized, departed and estranged themselves from God, that they could neither help themselves, nor be helped by any of their descendants, nor by angels, and so on. Now, it is not as crisp a statement of total depravity as we've seen elsewhere. And we will see before we get too far that they compromise the doctrine of total depravity. In Article 3, second paragraph on 296, is a nice summary of the way they think as regards the incarnation. You get the idea, as you read this, these are people who have read the scriptures, who believe in them, who love Christ, and who are strangers to speculation and aliens to philosophy. You're lucky if you find 10 abstract terms in the whole Dordrecht Confession. When they therefore speak of Christ's divinity, they say, how or in what manner this worthy body was prepared, or how the Word became flesh and He Himself man, we content ourselves with the declaration which the worthy evangelist has given. They eschew speculation. You won't find the fathers of the church, much less the councils of the church, quoted. There is therefore a literalness about these people that often can put the others to shame. It certainly gets them into many difficulties. Now, in Article 5, the law of Christ, on the one hand, there seems to be, and there is never too clear how far they depart from total depravity, but the second paragraph, 297, about the middle, he, speaking of Christ, in said testament, caused it to be declared that all men without distinction, if they are obedient through faith, follow, fulfill, and live according to the precepts of the same, are his children and rightful heirs. Now that all, that's no longer the Reformed tradition. Having thus excluded none from the precious inheritance of eternal salvation, he is at least verbally a direct contradiction of Calvin. And in fact, I would say that without sensing what they were exactly after, because this takes years to develop, I believe that from the very beginning, I mean from the beginning of evangelical and Reformed teaching on the continent, people differed from them, especially the more simple, you might say, followers of the Anabaptist and Free Church movement, differed from, you might say, the leaders, because they sensed instinctively there's something wrong with this business of a selective predestination. They felt we could all get a chance, even though we are, say, swineherds, blacksmiths, or farmers. They felt everybody should get a chance to go to heaven. There was a rugged simplicity about this which just couldn't quite follow Calvin in his complicated institutes. In fact, none are accepted except the unbelieving and disobedient, the headstrong and unconverted, who despise such salvation, and thus by their own actions. Oh, that's Arminianism. We're breathing a different air. Now, in the same context, although the following article, Article 6, on the page, top of page 298, you will see how, on the one hand, they are going to stress, as we will see, certain external practices, Nevertheless, in terms of the church itself, they don't believe that grace is tied in with external rituals of any kind. And that's when somebody asks, why with all the ritualism externally, they nevertheless would not be against, you might say, external forms of Christianity. Here's the explanation theologically. For neither baptism, supper, nor church fellowship. Well, now that's, what more they got? Baptism, Eucharist, nor belonging to the church, nor any other external ceremony can, without faith, the new birth and a change, help or qualify. In other words, it is man's internal, psychological, subjective union with God. Now, in a way, as I have told myself many times, this, if I may so use the term, this is authentic terminal Protestantism. In other words, the relatively simple peasants, or even among the clergy who arose from the peasants, who started the Anabaptist movement on the continent, then got into England, were people who in many ways were unfamiliar, mainly because they were not, you might say, involved, either because they were clergymen, or, and especially because they were very learned in the church's history. In other words, were not burdened by the externalia of the church prior to the Reformation. And consequently, when they reformed the church, they reformed it down to the bone. Article 7 of Holy Baptism summarizes the reason why they're called Anabaptists. It is both a description and a definition of their name. In other words, regarding baptism, we confess that all penitent believers, that excludes infants, must, on such scriptural confession of their faith, be baptized. In other words, this is what is called believer's baptism. It just implements what preceded. Luther, Calvin, and the rest who allowed infant baptism were compromisers. And the word must be used. Because what they did was, on the one hand, teach salvation by faith alone, on the other hand, allow such externals as baptism and baptism of infants. What can an infant contribute? The answer is nothing, except a sigh or a cry. Nothing. If infant baptism is effective, then, and this is good logic, and with a rugged peasant simplicity they saw it, if infant baptism is effective, then justification by faith alone is not true. Take it or leave it. And they left it. They left it. In the 8th article on the church, and we'll close with this, I just want you to notice they speak of a visible church of God up on top. And yet, when it comes to what they imply is the invisible church, in other words, they speak of the visible church first, then when they talk about the church of the living God, the qualities of membership, so to speak,